Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 387. This week, the questions are taken from Guide 455. That is the guide to SMS Falca, the Wednesday video on the Great Appia Cyclone, and the Friday video on the new evidence on the loss of HMS Hood. So let's begin. Almirante Brown asks, my copy of Jane's Fighting Ships of World War I mentions a 14-ship class of lightly armed Admiralty whalers built in 1915 under the Emergency War Programme. The ships are named after different whale species. Were these vessels used as patrol craft, or did they actually support Britain's whaling industry during the war? And what importance did the Entente and Allies assign to whaling as a source of raw materials during the World Wars? Were naval escorts assigned to whaling fleets and factory ships in both conflicts? So here is HMS Cachalot, which is an archaic term for a sperm whale, I believe. And these things were indeed built. They're put into three little formations and used actually as coastal anti-submarine escorts, HMS Black Whale being lost to a mine during the war, but mostly operating off the northern UK coast and the eastern Scottish coast, and quite a lot escorting convoys to and from Scandinavia, at least as far as they could go. Obviously, they're not going to go all the way to Scandinavia most of the time, because they are designed, as I said, for coastal work. They weren't used overseas to support a whaling industry, in part because Britain didn't really have much of a whaling industry by the First World War, and certainly by the Second. There was a large whaling industry based out of British-held territories, but it was actually mostly Norwegian. And there weren't really that many escorts at all dedicated to protecting that industry. In the First World War, the whaling industry was somewhat more important because whale oil and other parts of the whale were used to form things like glycerin for explosives, which was a bit more important in World War I than World War II, because in World War II, there were considerably more synthetic ways of making a lot of ingredients, in part sparked by the Germans not having access to global trade during World War I. But back in World War I, the areas where most whaling took place were obviously in the Arctic and the Antarctic, and they were far enough and remote enough from basically any World War I German anti-shipping activity that there wasn't really a need for any escorts, even. And there weren't really any escorts for them, even if they'd wanted them. In World War II, German surface raiders were, and U-boats for that matter, were a lot more able to get at the Norwegian whaling fleet. And indeed, a couple of German surface raiders, including Hilfskreuzer, did terrorise the Norwegian whaling fleet down in Antarctic waters and South Atlantic waters for a bit. However, once again, shortage of escorts, can't really afford to send your precious escorts to just go hanging around a whaling fleet that, you know, doesn't stick together all in one group like a convoy and tends to just wander around all over the place looking for whales. And they're still somewhat away from the main hunting areas for the Germans. Obviously, you know, the North Atlantic, where most of the trade is coming through, that's a much more lucrative area. So it's kind of a risk reward going on there. Plus, whaling was somewhat less important in World War II, as I said, because of the advances in synthetic ingredient manufacture for explosives and so forth. And that in turn meant that not only were they a lower priority, but in fact quite a lot of whalers and whaling ships got brought in by various navies and turned into auxiliaries or small warships. So the whaling fleet was already quite significantly reduced just by demands of various navies before you get into any kind of predation by German surface raiders. And so there was actually a whole debate in the aftermath of World War II as to whether or not whaling should be resumed. And one of the reasons that was cited by people in favour of resuming whaling was, well, hey, they've had 6 years to recover. And obviously the people who were against whaling said, well, given the life cycle of whales and just how many of them had been hunted in the early part of the 20th century, 6 years wasn't anywhere near enough for the population levels to recover to a point where commercial whaling would be viable without driving species to extinction. BK Zhong asks, why were so many warships built for the Confederacy only completed after the end of the American Civil War? Essentially, political interference by various governments, because when the American Civil War initially broke out, a lot of governments were hedging their bets. And so you bear in mind the American Civil War lasts, quote unquote, only about 4 years. So breaks out in 1861. In 1862, you start to see the Confederacy placing orders for ironclad and other warships to be built overseas by various people, because obviously with the Battle of Hampton Roads and so forth, it becomes clear that ironclad warships are very useful. But it also becomes clear that while the Confederates can build casemate ironclads like CSS Virginia, if they want to have something bigger, faster, and capable of actually smashing the Union blockade as opposed to resisting it, they don't have the resources to build that, but people overseas do. So you get things like what will eventually become Kotetsku, Scorpion and her sister ship Wyvern. You can see Scorpion here. And these ships are all ordered mostly in mid to late 1862. They start construction. A lot of them are in the water by 1863. And in theory, they would then be able to be delivered to the Confederacy in late 1863 or early 1864, at which point they could be used during the American Civil War. However, what then happens is by 1863-ish, give or take, public opinion in various countries, particularly Britain and France, which are the biggest warship building nations of the time, has started to shift considerably against the Confederacy. So whereas initially it's a foreign war and most of the calculations are political, and of course from Britain and France's perspective, in, you know, absolute cold-blooded politics, a nation the size of the United States that's having a civil war with itself and might split into two weaker nations that will then compete and waste resources in either open or latent hostilities against each other, is better for their overall prospects than having to deal with one big nation. So from a political perspective, it makes sense to essentially back the losing side, or the weaker side, in order to try and force a settlement where both sides still exist. But as more and more news about the American Civil War leaks out, and it becomes perceived as a pro-slavery versus anti-slavery war, the majority public opinion turns against the Confederacy, and thus governments start to put stop orders on this work. So, for example, Kotetsku is under construction, but then the French government says no French warship builder can sell warships to the Confederacy, and she actually ends up on her way to the Confederacy via the Danes anyway, but just a little bit too late. Scorpion and Wyvern, on the other hand, are seized by the British, by the Royal Navy, and put into service with them. And because obviously these ships aren't necessarily desired by the navies in question, but they're more being bought up just because, well, to prevent them getting into the hands of the Confederacy, there's no real urgency about completing them. And it takes a little while for them to be formally seized anyway, so work stops for a bit, and then they look at it and go, okay, well, what can we use them for? Okay, fine, I guess we'll complete them in this manner. And then you end up with a bunch of ships built either directly for, or in the case of SMS Falke, speculatively for the Confederacy, which are then completed afterwards, simply because without the ability to directly sell them to the Confederacy, and in some cases them being seized, it just takes a while for everyone to be bothered to get around to finishing them. Rap2X Trooper asks, during the Battle of Surigao Strait, at approximately 3:13 a.m. in the middle of the action, both sides reported a strange green light inexplicably appearing above them. From what I've read, this was likely to be a parachute flare dropped by a Japanese plane, possibly one of Yamashiro's float planes. Did the Japanese regularly use float planes at night, and were they alone in this regard? Also, what could have happened to the float plane given that Yamashiro went to the bottom not long after? And in general, what were float planes supposed to do if they ran low on fuel while their mother ships were busy, i.e. still in combat or manoeuvring, or in this case with Yamashiro, sinking? So yes, the Japanese did use float planes at night with a fair degree of regularity. When you look into the various battles around Guadalcanal, you see quite often float planes from various Japanese ships involved dropping flares, because this was part of their night fighting doctrine. Yes, they had a whole bunch of what we would today call night vision or low light level equipment, but one of the other aspects of their night fighting doctrine was, of course, they don't have radar. So if you send float planes out, then A, hopefully they can find your target in the darkness. And that's actually easier than you might think, because obviously you wouldn't launch a float plane into complete darkness, super heavy cloud cover, or if it was a moonless night. But if there is moon and starlight to a reasonable degree, having a perspective from up high obviously not only widens your angle of view, but it lets you see things like ships' wakes a lot easier. And of course, those kind of tend to point to the ships. And then if you drop a parachute flare or two over the target, not only does it point out where the target is for the Japanese ships, which are obviously concealed in darkness, but in theory, it might also ruin the enemy's night vision, because they've got big burning light above them. And even if it doesn't, for whatever reason, it's still providing a huge amount of high contrast light in the proximity of the enemy vessel, which is, overall, it's just going to make spotting the Japanese ships hiding out in the darkness much, much harder. Were they alone in this regard? Not entirely. There were ideas for similar practices by other navies, especially navies that practiced quite a bit of night fighting action during the 1930s. However, by the time you get really stuck into World War II, the majority of other navies, like the Royal Navy, that had extensive night fighting doctrines, had at that point usually started to equip with radar, and therefore the radar spotting took over the role of the float plane spotting and parachute flares, which of course is a little bit more fraught, a little bit more difficult. And therefore, while the use of float planes at night is done by other navies, it's on a much reduced scale compared to what the Japanese would do, because of course the Japanese would eventually have radar, but not for a good long while during their participation in World War II, and thus the use of float planes far more commonly. Now, if that green light at Surigao Strait was from one of Yamashiro's float planes, then I suspect it probably would have just headed off to the Philippines, because bear in mind, yes, the US is invading the Philippines, but it's invading the Philippines because there is a substantial amount of Japanese weaponry and soldiers there. And at that point during Surigao Strait, a good chunk of the Philippines is still occupied by the Japanese. So with its mothership gone, the floatplane pilot could have just headed off roughly northwest and found a Japanese seaplane base or similar to land and meet up with his compatriots. And in general terms, if a floatplane is running low on fuel while the mothership is still busy, there are some options, but it probably needs to be stated at the beginning that it shouldn't happen, because float planes are designed to have fairly long endurance times, so they should be able to come back with a good margin of fuel. Therefore, if their mothership is busy, they can just orbit and wait for it to be less busy. But if the mothership is very busy, say it's still in combat somehow after, you know, several hours of the float plane buzzing around, or it's heavily manoeuvring, then either you just circle on whatever low fuel you've got and hope that things come to an end quickly, or you can land. It is, after all, a float plane, so you can just land at sea with a bit of fuel in reserve and wait things out. Obviously, if there's combat going on, you try and land a little bit further away, if possible. If the mothership is sinking, on the other hand, well, that's a little bit more of a problem. At that point, your best bet is to find another friendly ship that isn't sinking and land near them and hope that they can either hoist you on board or, worst case, they can at least take the crew on board rather than the plane itself. Raptor Beast asks, it seems like the general idea of a ship in a storm was to either avoid it, be ashore, or hope for the best if it were caught in one at sea. Were there any attempts during the period the channel covers to build a storm-proof ship, i.e. make it where it would be nearly impossible for it to capsize, founder, etc., even in extremely rough weather? Technically speaking, yes. So you had some early RNLI lifeboats, well, early in the 20th century at least, like this one, and actually a preceding class, which were what they call self-righting. So you can actually, and that's something that's actually carried through even into modern RNLI lifeboats, you can tip these things upside down 180 degrees, and assuming that they're still vaguely intact when they go over, i.e. you haven't smashed in a massive portion of their cabins or whatever, they will just pop back up the right way. However, while this is, for obvious reasons, a very useful feature in lifeboats, it that is really not something that you want in a big ship. Because for one thing, all your load has to be very low down. Your center of gravity has to be really low, which can be done for a lifeboat, obviously. But in a more regular ship, if you're a warship, for example, with big heavy gun turrets up top, or you're a cargo ship who wants to load yourself all the way up to the gunwales or possibly higher with heavy cargo, it's just not possible to get your center of gravity down that low. Likewise, lifeboat being relatively small, and therefore you can consider it somewhat more rigid than a full-size ship, is much easier to make fully waterproof, because that's one of the key elements of a self-righting boat. You have to keep it fully waterproof, and ideally with a fairly large amount of empty volume sealed up top, which obviously then provides quite significant buoyancy, which helps A, stay afloat at all, and B, pop back up again. On a considerably larger vessel where there's a lot more flexing, it probably isn't possible to do that, because if you're in an environment where that ship is bowled over, the sheer amount of force involved is probably going to start hatches, rip open rivet seams and welding joints and bits and pieces of the hull structure, especially the superstructure. So keeping it fully watertight is going to be a lot more difficult. Plus, of course, with warships, if they're in that kind of situation, chances are someone's probably blown big holes in them anyway. And another important thing, which is something I probably need to do a video on at some point, is metacentric height. And in very, very brief terms, if you have a low metacentric height, which is fairly close to the center of gravity, you get a ship that will roll almost all the time, but roll quite gently. So you're trading off the fact that you're very rarely, if ever, level with the fact that the movement is, as I said, relatively gentle. If you have a really high metacentric height, then it's much more difficult to knock you off of being level. But when you do, you're going to snap back to that height or to that level very quickly. So in calmer waters, a ship with a high metacentric height is actually a really good gun platform because it's very, very steady. But the minute you hit rough waters, it becomes, frankly, a terrible gun platform because it's going to be whipping about all over the place. And so for warships, they have to make a compromise in where you want your metacentric height to be. However, with a self-righting vessel, you want your metacentric height to be as high as physically possible, because that is going to contribute to, you know, even if the ship is over at 90 degrees, 100 degrees, 130 degrees, it's still going to want to flip back upright. And, well, that, again, that's great if you're a lifeboat, and in most seas it will keep you very, very level until you get really, really rough seas, which can be a good thing, but the minute you hit any kind of really rough waters enough to, you know, take you off of level, it's going to be an extremely uncomfortable ride because you're going to whip back and forth like you wouldn't believe. Now, again, if you're a lifeboat riding through extremely rough seas to go and rescue somebody from a ship that's sunk or sinking, the fact the boat is whipping back and forth and smashing back and forth probably doesn't make too much odds to you, because the boat's probably being thrown back and forth anyway by the rough weather. But on a merchant ship or a warship, that high of a metacentric height would be incredibly uncomfortable the minute you hit anything like rough seas, and therefore pretty much impractical. Knight 6831 asks, why did the Germans and Americans seem to hope that Samoa's coconut farming would be a profitable and sustainable source of income when the British and French controlled, as far as I'm aware, the major producers of coconuts? Simply put, there was far more demand than there was supply. The thing is, these days we primarily think of coconuts, I think most of us would do, in terms of a food stuff, either eating it directly or, it my preferred form, in desiccated form, because I absolutely love myself some coconut cake. Nonetheless, back in the 19th century, that really wasn't a thing. Desiccated coconut as a baking ingredient was starting to come about. However, and this is somewhat similar to the whale question earlier on, in the 19th and even in the early 20th century, a lot of things where today we either have and commonly use oil-based chemicals, materials, whatever, or we have some kind of synthetic option like plastics and so forth, nylon, for example, back then, a lot of those things either didn't exist or were far too difficult and expensive to produce. And so you have natural materials being used instead. For example, with explosives, guano, prior to the Haber process, was a vital ingredient in making modern high explosives at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And with coconuts, there were two primary products from a coconut that you could make a lot of use of. Firstly, the husk, that, you know, the brown bit, that was very useful in all sorts of things, you know, ropes, stuffing, turning it into fabric, packing material, and so on and so forth. Coconut fiber being a good alternative to bubble wrap. Well, you know, the predecessor, I guess, because bubble wrap didn't exist back then. And then the actual meat, the white bit inside the nut, that would then be dried and turned into what is called copra, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And the oil and other things that could be extracted from that, plus the material itself, could be turned into all sorts of things, or used as an ingredient in all sorts of things. Soap, candles, certain kinds of foods. For example, you could make a butter substitute using it. And what was left after you'd pressed all the oil out could be fed to livestock. So an individual coconut could be almost entirely used in various processes, all of which had a fairly high demand. And so both the Germans and the Americans are thinking, well, you know, if we can get mass coconut farming going in Samoa, then we can make a lot of money because the market cap for these kind of things is not limited by the supply that Britain and France can give to the world. It's limited by, well, how much can the world use? And if that demand significantly exceeds supply, then adding a whole bunch of new supply just means more money. Warrant Officer Will asks, recently I became aware of medicanes, a term for when a hurricane-like cyclonic storm forms in the Mediterranean, reaching strengths of a Category 1 to 2 hurricane. Although the phenomenon has only started to be officially recorded since the 1980s, do we have any possible accounts of storms either at sea or in port during the period this channel covers that have in fact been encounters with this previously unknown weather phenomena? I suspect there are a great many, because of course weather phenomena usually don't appear completely out of nowhere, and it's more modern observation methods have allowed us to classify these things and say, this is this kind of storm system, but this is another kind of storm system. Whereas when you look at the frequency of these, let's call them medicanes, that's a really terrible term because it sounds like they should be some kind of medicinal thing, like a medicated candy cane or something. But nevertheless, when you look back through the Age of Sail, the medieval period, the Age of Antiquity, etc., people are always saying, don't travel in the Mediterranean in autumn, winter, because you will die horribly to all sorts of horrible storms. Look at when the medicanes tend to show up. Oh, look, they show up from September through to February, right in the middle of the bit where everybody says, don't sail in the Mediterranean unless you want to die. So as well as the more standard heavy winds and storms that brew up in the Mediterranean, these things would have been mixed in with those, and you're basically going to see both of them either or combining, taking out all sorts of ships. And I think the main way that you would distinguish them if you were looking through old accounts is that although both are obviously associated with a lot of rain and cloud as well, a hurricane or cyclone type storm usually involves huge excessive amounts of rain, whereas gales and so forth can actually blow up with that relatively minimal amounts of rain, although they kick up a lot of water off the surface, so it doesn't really make much odds to you if you're standing there. You're still going to get absolutely soaked. But yeah, if you look through the various accounts and look for big storms in the Mediterranean and you see, look, in this one, everyone makes note of the fact there's a huge amount of rain as well as tempestuous winds. That's probably a medicane that's being experienced, as opposed to just sheer driving winds that smash ships into rocks and tear apart their rigging. The Mighty Nanto asks, was Len West still on Prince of Wales when it was sunk by the Japanese? And if so, did he also give an account of the ship's last moments? This is from the New Evidence on Hood video. So I did send some follow-up questions in the aftermath of the video. Sadly, although perhaps not unexpectedly, Len West has subsequently passed away since sending the original letter where he detailed his experiences. But we did get some additional information. So he was not on Prince of Wales when it was dispatched, as Part 4 said, at the end of the year. By that point, he'd transferred to, I believe, HMS Dragon, obviously before it was sent over to serve in the Free Polish Navy. And so he wasn't part of the ship sinking. Ruben Sandwich asks, how credible do you put this account? Now, this is a question that popped up quite a few times in the comments, because obviously this is coming quite a long time after the incident. I would say, having obviously examined it before I put pen to paper in both the video and the article that was published by Britain at War magazine, I would say I'd rate it as pretty credible. There's several reasons for that. Firstly, the position that he was in with the pom-pom gunners, you can kind of see them here between the bridge and the fore funnel, that is a perfect observation position for what he describes seeing. And also, he was one of the Prince of Wales crew who really didn't have all that much to do at the time, so he had time to observe things. So from that perspective, you know, are the things that he described things that someone in his position would have seen? Yes. Also, the sort of the broad strokes of the sequence of events that he describes are in keeping with other descriptions of events that we have from various other people who were there, both people who testified immediately afterwards at the Admiralty Inquiry and people who talked about things later on in life. And the additional details that are provided in his account, things like the exact nature of the sea state and so forth, again, they don't directly conflict with anything that we know already, and in many cases enhance what we already know. So again, it is consistent with the known evidence. And even in areas where you're looking at it and you're going, okay, that's not strictly true, like, for example, Prince of Wales's later engagement with Bismarck, where, to his recollection, hits were scored. The way that it's described and the reasons why he describes those things still line up with what would have been available to him at the time. Because, of course, he doesn't have the omniscient eye of, you know, people reconstructing the whole thing later on, where they can say, oh yeah, well, Prince of Wales didn't actually hit Bismarck. What he does have is the ability to talk to the radar operators on Prince of Wales while they're engaging, and they're tracking the outgoing shells, and they can see what they think are hits, so they're going to tell him that there are hits, and therefore he is going to believe that there are hits, because why not? They're the only people who can tell him on the ship what is going on. And again, when we look into that whole incident, it is consistent with what was reported at the time. They believed that, depending on who was being interviewed, they believed that they either had straddles or hits, but obviously not enough to significantly deter Bismarck. As it turns out, it was straddles, not hits, but that it's what you might call an error that actually increases plausibility, because it is exactly the kind of error somebody in those circumstances would make. And of course, there are the inevitable questions of, well, if this account is being given 80 odd years later, how reliable could human memory be? Well, of course, yes, human memory is fallible to a certain degree, but equally, there are people who remember things that they did in their youth, and when you go back and check against their description, that is exactly what happened, because everybody's memory works slightly differently. And of course, one thing that we don't know, and at this point we won't know, is, you know, when exactly was this first recorded? Is there something that perhaps sensing that he's coming to the end of his life, Len West decided, I might as well put this in writing and share it with everyone? Or is it something that he perhaps wrote down much earlier in life and then decided, again, perhaps towards the end of his life, actually, you know what, I'm going to take that and share it with everybody now? And of course, again, you can make arguments, if it's been written down much earlier, it's probably a lot fresher in his mind. But then you get into the whole science of human memory. And as I said, you know, some people can tell you what they did last week and be hilariously wrong about it. Other people can tell you what they did 50, 60, well, in this case, 80 years ago, and be completely correct about it, and everything in between. So just because it's eyewitness testimony does from a distant period doesn't necessarily give us any particular reason, unless we can prove some major flaw with it in other ways, to disbelieve it. I mean, you know, the two Hood survivors who actually talked about what they went through continued to talk about what they went through decades later on, and their stories remained pretty consistent. And there's a reason, you know, veterans of World War II are interviewed in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and even the few that's still around now in the 2010s and 2020s, because that information is valuable. GTH042 asks, thinking about discrepant accounts of where shells land around a fast-moving target, might the duration of the plume add discrepancy as to when, and thus where, the shell strikes the water? With the enormous scale of the plumes, I imagine it takes a fair bit of time for the water to rise that far and then fall back. In this time, the target will have continued moving. Should a shell fall near amidships, might the plume from a big shell be visible long enough to someone, say, blinking, to first notice it as being astern? Not that it adds material insights on Hood's demise, but I'm curious as to how long those plumes are visible with respect to the target's motion and length. That's actually a very good observation. So I went and looked at various film footage of battleship shells landing and timed from the minute you start to see a plume emerge to when the plume is mostly faded out, because what tends to happen is obviously you get the big surge of water, as you like you can see here, coming up, which is very quick and visible initially. Then it kind of reaches a peak, and then rather than it all collapsing back again, obviously the, if you like, the denser bits of water just fall out, leaving a bit of vapor in the air and mist and so forth. And so what you tend to get is a kind of a fading out. It does slightly collapse, but it's more kind of, it just becomes more and more transparent. And while, if you like, a ghost of the plume is still there, roughly speaking, for battleship shells, it seems to be about 10 seconds from the initial plume starting to break the water to it having mostly faded out, to the point that you'd very easily recognise that that's an old plume where most of the water's gone. And that's actually quite evenly split. So it takes about 4 or 5 seconds to go from the initial plume coming up out of the water to it reaching its maximum intensity, and then about another 5 seconds for the water to fall back again. And then maybe in between 3 and 8 seconds for what's left of the vapor cloud to dissipate. Obviously, wind is going to affect that quite a bit in the latter stages. So, yes, if a shell hit, let's say, near amidships, then somebody who's not immediately paying attention, like, oh, look over there. If you're delayed by 2-3 seconds from looking at it, you will see that plume, if it's close to a moving ship, somewhere slightly different from where it initially landed. And so, for sake of argument, if you're looking at a ship going at, I don't know, 28 knots, roughly 32 miles an hour, in the space of about 10 seconds, that moves a little bit over 450 feet, which for a ship the size of something like Hood is about half a ship's length. Obviously, for a ship that's shorter than that, like, say, a South Dakota, that'd be a considerably larger portion of the ship's overall length. But if we foreshorten that still more and say, you know, someone's looking away and someone goes, oh, hey, look over there, and you turn and look, and maybe it's, let's say, 4 seconds between the shell impact and you actually taking a look, then in that time, with a little bit of margin either side, that shell plume will be about between 150 and 200 feet away from where it originally landed relative to the ship. Obviously, the plume stays in place, but let's say it lands dead amidships or adjacent to a ship, dead amidships. If it takes you about 4 seconds to turn and look, then, well, it's going to be about 180 at 4 seconds. So it would appear, when you look at it, to be about 180 feet further back. But then again, if you knew what you were looking for, you well, you might not be able to estimate exactly where it should have been, because obviously you don't necessarily know exactly how fast the ship that the shell has landed near is moving, but you will usually be able to estimate, you know, how old is this shell plume and should I move it therefore roughly somewhat forward? Because if you look around and it's still erupting out of the water and it's maybe only 20, 30, 40 feet tall, it's probably within, you know, 10, 20 feet of where it landed relative to the ship originally. Whereas if you look up and it's no longer a solid plume, it's more of a vapor construct, a bit like the plume you can see on the left here in this picture, then you know, okay, that probably looked somewhat different when it actually landed relative to its position on the ship. Alex Moskowitz asks, does the sea state that Len reported affect your theory on Hood in any way? Yes and no. And I know that's somewhat unhelpful. So for those who may not be aware, who haven't seen that, the original video, my theory on Hood is that as she was proceeding through the water, obviously she displaces water. That's a physical reality. And any naval shipbuilding manual worth its salt will tell you that there is a direct relationship between the length of the ship, the speed of the ship, and the wavelength of the bow wave that is caused by the ship displacing water. And funnily enough, if you plug the numbers in, you end up with a wave trough. So obviously you have a bow wave crest, that's the high part, followed by a trough, the low part, then a crest, then a trough, then a crest, then a trough, until it eventually runs out of energy. And the second trough ends up basically around about the air of the mainmast, so kind of the aft machinery space and the 4-inch HA magazine. And that is deep enough that, at least in my theory, either a shell from Bismarck might have been able to just skip under the armor belt entirely, or if it, so basically we're talking about short, relatively speaking, but even if the depth wasn't deep enough at that particular moment, it still would have significantly reduced the amount of water that the shell would have to pass through relative to Hood in a static, calm condition. And therefore, because of that reduced length of water, it could pass through and either way get in under the armor belt, through the aft machinery space, and into the 4-inch HA magazine, or detonating perhaps on the bulkhead there, causing that to catch fire, then causing that fire vents through the hole in the machinery spaces up through the vents, which causes the initial flame, and then as the pressure builds, it collapses the aft 15-inch bulkhead, which then causes the 15-inch magazines to go up. Anyway, you can actually see pretty much exactly the kind of thing I'm describing happening here, and this is a photo of Hood taken from an aircraft a day or two before she is destroyed, and you can see exactly what's going on. You can, I mean, at this point in this particular photo, obviously her bow is plunging slightly, but you can see there's the crest of the bow wave right up at the bow. There's a trough that's running actually past the main armament up front. Then it starts to rise into a crest again, basically centrally on the machinery, kind of aft boiler rooms, forward turbines. Then it drops off rather precipitously, exactly where my theory says it should when the Hood's proceeding at speed. And, well, you can see just how much of the underwater paint is exposed in that area. Now, with that recap in place, does the fairly heavy sea state that Len reported affect my theory? Now, as a yes and no. Yes, in that it makes the shot even more a one in a million shot, but no, in that it doesn't rule out, it doesn't materially affect my theory in terms of saying it can't happen. It just means that that window of opportunity has gotten, you know, even narrow, i.e. the window would come and go, and thus the fact that the shell comes in is even more of a one in a million shot than it already was. But as we all know, that this kind of shot, whatever theory you subscribe to, is still an incredibly unlucky one in a million shot. It's not something that would be easily predictable by the standards of when Hood was being constructed. And the reason I I say that is because you have a thing called constructive and destructive interference. Now, for those of you who know what I'm talking about, forgive me, but for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about or may have forgotten high school physics or whatever, essentially, when you have waves, whether they be light waves, radio waves, in this case, waves at the sea, in the sea, they have a wavelength, so the distance between crests or the distance between troughs, and they have an amplitude, that is the height of the wave above the median, the where it would be if there wasn't a wave. And when two waves encounter each other, then you can have constructive interference. So that is if the crest of one wave overlaps precisely or mostly precisely with the crest of another wave, then the energy that's available is, of course, a sum of those the two energies in the separate waves, and thus the amplitude gets higher. And similarly for a trough, if two troughs meet up, either exactly or close to, the trough gets deeper. The flip side to that is destructive interference, and that is when, obviously, at the crest of one wave meets the trough of another wave, and therefore, if we say the first wave it has its trough and the interfering wave has its crest, then it's going to reduce the depth of the trough. Or likewise, if you have the trough of the second wave, it's going to reduce the height of the crest. And how much that happens is going to depend, obviously, on the energy involved in each wave, which is a function of both the amplitude of the wave and the wavelength. Because if you have a really, really short wavelength, then even if the crest is quite high, it's not an exact science, but if you think about the area, if you describe it as like a sine wave on a graph, the area underneath the wave or above the wave in the case of a trough can be seen as roughly proportional to the amount of energy in it. So if you've got a really big, long wavelength wave with a certain amplitude, then that's going to have considerably more energy in the overall, let's say, peak or crest than a short wavelength wave with similar or slightly less amplitude. And obviously then interference is going to be more local than absolute. But then this gets further complicated because, of course, not all waves move at the same speed. The wavelength of the ship's bow wave running down the vessel's side, that is dictated by how fast is the water being displaced and obviously the ship's speed. Whereas the speed of the sea state, the waves produced by the natural sea state, and the direction of these, because they're not necessarily both moving in the same direction, but both speed and direction will be different to, well, most of the time, they're going to be different to the bow wave. And so rather than get a consistent standing pattern of either constructive or destructive interference, which is more of what you'd get with radio or light waves, in this case, what you would get is that at times you would have constructive interference, and at other times you would have destructive interference, and that would depend entirely on what the moment-by-moment interaction between the waves is. So, for example, if you had the trough and the wave crest, obviously, if Hood is travelling at, let's say, 28 knots, that is consistent. It's going to be in the same place as long as Hood travels at 28 knots. If a crest of a wave from the sea state interacts with that trough at, you know, the moment of the shell's arrival, then the trough is going to be shallower, and therefore the shell is more likely to impact water, has a longer distance of water to go through, more likely to explode outside the ship, therefore making my theory less likely. Conversely, if at the moment in question a trough from the sea state is interacting with the trough adjacent to the aft machinery spaces and 4-inch magazine, then that trough is going to be deepened, which makes the shell's path much easier, perhaps likely to not encounter any water at all. And this is going to be changing on a moment-by-moment basis. So, yeah, with a very heavy sea state, obviously with, therefore, quite energetic waves, at any given moment, this area of potential weakness may have been completely covered up, or it may have been, in another moment, very much more exposed. And unless someone had a camera pointing a reasonable down angle looking at Hood all the time, you're not going to be able to predict on a moment-by-moment basis whether that is the case or not. But obviously then results can speak for themselves. If the shell gets in there, that indicates that perhaps the trough was either as deep as it should be or deeper, i.e. there was constructive interference going on at that moment. And there's actually some moments in some quite nice colour footage that survived of HMS Hood just before the war, when she's moving through actually relatively calm waters, where you can see exactly the kind of thing that I'm pointing out, both with this picture and with my theory. Obviously, at that point, her bow wave is not being interfered with all that much because it's a very calm sea. But you can actually see, even in that relatively low angle footage, a huge amount of the boot topping is exposed amidships, which is obviously the problem area. Damian Parowski asks, I have a bit of an oddball question. How long would it take to fuel a battleship the size of HMS Hood? And what would be the longest bit of the operation to make the ship ready? Stocking food and dry goods, loading ammo, fueling, finding all the men and dragging them out for local pubs? Honestly, it's a question that's like, how long is a piece of string? Because it greatly depends on how much of whatever it is you're loading do you need to load, and how urgent is it? So, for example, if the ship's come in with 2/3 of her fuel still aboard, obviously it's going to be much quicker to fuel her up, all things else being equal, than if she's running on near empty. And the same thing with food, ammo, etc. But on top of that, as I said, it's a question of how urgent things are, and to a certain extent also infrastructure. Because, you know, if you've come back and there's almost no, let's say, food and dry goods aboard, but you receive orders that this ship has got to sail in 2 days, you can put a lot of the ship's crew onto that effort. And as long as you can keep supplying them with the goods, if you've got several hundred people working on it rather than several dozen, obviously everything gets loaded a heck of a lot faster. Ammunition perhaps has a slightly lower flexibility because obviously, you know, you do have to handle that with a certain amount of care and attention. But with things like fuel, not only is it how much fuel are you loading on board, but also what kind of equipment have you got available? You know, do you just have the one pump? Are you refueling at sea with perhaps a low pressure pump and a relatively narrow hose? Are you refueling alongside one of the major oil hulks or depots, which can put multiple fuel lines with fairly high pressure and very large hoses? Because at that point, you know, topping up 20% of your tank with a single low volume tanker might take longer than filling the thing from top to bottom using 3 or 4 high pressure, high volume lines in a dockyard setting. YouTubes asks, so what was burning after the hit that made a flame from the blower look like a blowtorch? That description sounds like something highly volatile burning, like powder. It's almost certainly the 4-inch HA magazine that's going up at that point. Now, as I said before, in theory, what's happening is the 4-inch magazine is cooking off. That fireball is then being pushed out through initially the hole that the shell blew through the bulkhead, and quite probably that bulkhead is in the process of collapsing, so that hole is getting larger. It's going into the aft engine space, and then it's going up the vents. And now, of course, the vents are quite confined, so you've got a building pressure with lots of heat, obviously, and flame going up there. But those vents have a limited cross-section and limited volume that they can transmit per second, so if the pressure is building up behind it, it's going to end up jetting up very high with a very concentrated directed flame, like they say, like a blowtorch. I mean, a very basic example of this would be if you have one of those back pumpers that looks like a metal bin with holes poked in the bottom. They usually come with a lid with a little chimney type thing on top. Now, if you fill it up with paper or cardboard or whatever, set fire to it, you get a nice energetic flame, but it's kind of a general flame. It's going upwards, but, you know, there's bits and pieces of it all over the place here and there. And it kind of billowing and licking and everything. But if you put the lid over it, you've got the same amount of energy being generated in there, but it's now got a limited amount of volume to an area to force itself through. And suddenly you get a much more, if you like, concentrated, regular blowtorch, almost like flame coming up the middle. And that's essentially what's happening with Hood here. Until, of course, it can't vent the pressure and the heat fast enough through this, which would then lead to the collapse of the 15-inch bulkhead, which is the next weakest thing, and then kaboom. Corbett MD asks, I'd like to know who painted the scene that's up in part of the video, e.g. at 2123 and also the thumbnail. A reverse image search doesn't turn anything up. That would be this one. This is a rather fantastic painting by a friend of mine called Joseph Reindler. And some of you may recognise that name because he's actually been on the channel before when I did a video with him about naval artwork. So you can search through the channel if you want to watch that video. But he's very kindly given me permission to use this image, obviously with full credit, because frankly, it's one of the best depictions of Hood's last moment. You know, he's thoroughly researched exactly what all the witness reports said Hood was doing, what she looked like at the time. You've got the shell splashes as they were described by the various survivors. You've got this building blowtorch-like flame near the mainmast, which is what we saw in the sketch in the previous question. So this is a matter of moments before the ship explodes. And you'll notice if you zoom in that she even has two blue flying, the signal that she was flying when she went boom. So I've also included a link in the video description where you can visit his website and where you can get professional prints of this painting. I have one and it's very, very nice. Nathapron Hong Sharon asks, the smallest 40,000-ton Alsace design had three triple 15-inch. Why even bother with a brand new turret type rather than just repeating Clemenceau or Gascogne's design? Surely a single gun couldn't possibly have been worth the headache that changing the turret would give. And on the other hand, was the quadruple turret big enough to be switched over to a triple 18-inch design so the big 12-gun 3-quad design could potentially have 9 18-inch guns? It's partly to do with the origins of the program. So the original program, or the designs for the Alsace, they kind of grow out of what a design known as C3, which was, in turn, one of the design options that was considered when they were deciding what they were going to do with Clemenceau and Gascogne after having laid down Richelieu and Jean Bar. And C3 was a three triple 15-inch turret design. Now, what's in World of Warships, because, well, obviously as a paper-only sketch, World of Warships is probably the only place you're going to find a 3D representation. They have Flandre, which is, by the description, a C3, because they say this is a project that leads on to the Alsace designs, which is what C3 would be. But the layout of the main and secondary batteries for C3 and the smallest of the Alsace designs is functionally identical. And in fact, the secondary battery layout on Flandre doesn't match either C3 or the small Alsace. It more closely matches the C3 because you have the triple stack second tertiary, I guess, at that point, guns at the back, but on the small Alsace, you'd have four, so essentially delete the middle of each of the triple stacks there. And on the C3, you have the three at the back, and then aircraft launching facilities where you have the forward triple stack on Flandre. So essentially what they've done is they've given you the Jean Bar style AA retrofit for post-war for Flandre. Probably given the triple stack layout on a C3 hull and the description, but nonetheless, it gives you a general idea of roughly what it may or may not look like. Now, the reason for this is that, yes, you know, designing a triple turret is a bit of a pig for the French because they've only ever done twins and quads, so it'd be a brand new turret design. But if you want an increased lethality on your battleship, this is pretty much the only way they can do it, because their big problem, as you've heard me say on many dry docks, is infrastructure, dock size. And if they go with another quadruple 15-inch turret, which they do on the maximal Alsace design, that means a massively longer ship. It's just not going to work with their existing infrastructure. They're going to have to do huge infrastructure upgrades. Whereas C3... and kind of just about mini Alsace, or micro Alsace, I guess we could call it, is just about, you can fit it in the largest elements of existing French infrastructure, or you can very slightly upgrade those bits of infrastructure and you can build it. So yes, it is a whole lot of effort to get an extra gun, but you are getting that extra gun. And you know, considering that they're designing ships or trying to design ships in response to the H-39 and potential subsequent German battleships, they're trying to squeeze a quart into a pint pot, to coin a phrase. But, you know, what is the absolute heaviest armament we can get and still not have to completely rebuild our entire naval infrastructure? The intermediate, of course, between this and 12 15-inch guns is to do triple 16-inch guns. And that's the middle Alsace design. But the triple 16-inch and the quad 15-inch both would require significant infrastructure upgrades. And that actually leads to a little bit of a, shall we say, a difference in opinion between various historians. For example, Doolin and Garsky believe that if the Alsace program had gone ahead, the French would have selected the quad 15-inch design, so 12 guns, so two quads forward and one aft, because it gives you maximal firepower and still reuses the existing quadruple 15-inch design. So you, quote-unquote, only have to pay to upgrade all the infrastructure, and the actual building of the ship should be relatively straightforward. And John Jordan and Robert Dumas, who wrote the French Battleships 1922 to 1956 book, they actually think it's the other way around. They think this design or something close to it would have been the choice, because although you've got the extra expense and risk of building a triple turret design, it's one that you could do with minimal to no changes to your infrastructure. And interestingly enough, no one thinks the French would have gone for the triple 16-inch version, the mid design, which is actually, you know, the middle of the road design is usually what ends up getting selected. But everyone agrees that if they'd built that, it would have been so big you have had to do the major infrastructure upgrades that you'd need for the quad 15-inch design anyway, and you have the additional problems of building a new triple turret design and hoping that works, and you have the problems of building a new 16-inch gun and hoping that works, and then you have the wonderful logistics of introducing yet another caliber to both the French battle fleet generally and the French modern battle fleet in particular, because remember at this point, they've got technically the corbeta kind of still, there's one or two still around, so okay, they'll be out fairly soon, so at the time these things are being designed, so you can probably ignore the 12-inch, but then you've got the 13.4-inch shells on the Britannias, the 13-inch shells on the Dunkirks, the 15-inch shells on the Richelieus, and if you introduce the 16-inch shells, it basically means every single class of battleship likely to be in service when the Alsace, whatever it is, enter service, has a different caliber of gun, which is going to cause no end of logistical headaches. And the second part was the quadruple turret big enough to the quad 15, that is, to turn into a triple 18. Well, rule of thumb based on other nations is that you plus 2 inches on caliber, minus 1 on gun turret size for a similar barbette size. So that would actually suggest a 17-inch gun. And interestingly enough, much as people slate the Republique in World of Warships for being mostly made up, one of the things that is actually definitive about it is that the French were looking at a 17-inch gun design. Didn't get very far before, obviously, war took over. But potentially, obviously, again, not a huge amount known, but potentially that does suggest that maybe someone somewhere was thinking, quad 15 turned into triple 17? Question mark? Le ho ho ho. Seb Dove asks, in a world increasingly drifting toward negative news, can you tell us about the most uplifting, wholesome, dash, everyone behaves excellently story from military naval history? There's a whole load. I mean, it depends exactly on what you view as wholesome and uplifting. So one example would be the story of David Wanklyn here on the left. Now, many of you may know that he was a very famous submarine commander before his vessel was sunk in the Second World War, but fewer know that he was actually colorblind, which for most naval service would be, you don't get to be in the Navy if you can't differentiate red from green and things like this. However, back in the 20s, when he was trying to sign up for the Navy, his enthusiasm for doing so was so clear that one of the doctors who was administering the test actually took him aside and spent some time basically essentially going, look, you see that as this colour and that is correct, but you see this other colour as the same colour. But if you look very carefully, there's very subtle differentiation on the shading. So if you see that shade, say that it's, let's say, green. And if you see that shade, say that it's red. and essentially helped him cheat through his admissions. And, well, the Royal Navy benefited greatly from that. At the Battle of Trafalgar, of course, you have HMS Africa having engaged the entire French vanguard, rocking up next to Santissima Trinidad, which is a massive disparity of force, considering Santissima Trinidad is a four-decker first-rate and Africa is a small, notionally two-decker 64-gunner. But they think that Santissima Trinidad has surrendered, so they send a boat over. Santissima Trinidad has not, in fact, surrendered. She is, in fact, very heavily engaged with a number of Royal Navy vessels on her opposite side, hence why they don't notice Africa. But then Africa's boarding party arrive on deck to some confusion from the Spanish, who wonder where these British sailors have come from. And then they say, hey, look, we're from HMS Africa. Yeah, no, we're on the other side. Yeah, we thought you'd surrendered and we've come over to accept your surrender. And the Spanish officers, bearing in mind they are violently exchanging cannon fire with a couple of Royal Navy vessels on the starboard side of their ship at this point, is that just turning around and go, no, I'm terribly sorry. There's been some kind of big mistake. We are, in fact, still upholding the honour of our country and fighting your countrymen, as you can see, if you will look over here, at which point Africa's crewmen go, oh, I see, very sorry, made a mistake, clearly. Well, we should probably let you get back to doing that because we don't want to interfere with honourable conduct since you haven't yet officially surrendered. And of course, at that point, you would usually expect the Spanish crew to have at least take prisoner these people who have randomly wandered onto their ship. But no, the Spanish crew are just like, yep, okay, perfectly understandable. I mean, this battle really is chaotic. Here, we'll show you back to your boat, and as and when we do decide to surrender, if we do so, we will accept that honourably as well. See you later. And Africa's crew just go back to HMS Africa. They're like, they're very nice people. Also, we should probably shoot them. Because, of course, if it's not surrendered, then it is a valid target. Slow Pixie asks, in Dry Dock 378 Part 2, you answered my question about the Swedish Crown Prince Gustav Adolf class. You mentioned that due to their expected theatre of operation, they may not have been as good deep ocean performers compared to more standard ships of the line. Their dimensions are similar to other 64-gun third rates, so would they just be a bit more prone to rolling? Would they be considered bad sailors, etc.? And another source I found says that to avoid compromising on their seakeeping, when they were rearmed, their broadside was made up of shorter barrel guns, meaning that their 36 and 24 pounder regunning was about as heavy as the previously installed 24 and 18 pounders while still providing more firepower and similar accuracy. Is there a trade-off in there that isn't being mentioned, or was that just a really good idea? So with regards to the guns, the main trade-off there would be that you would have, with a shorter barrel, you would have less range and slightly less punching power, because if you have a longer barreled 36 or 24 pounder, then obviously the gunpowder has more time to burn in the barrel, therefore the ball is going to fly faster, and therefore it's going to go further, it's going to hit with more power at a given range, and even at the shorter ranges where both a long and a short barrel version, so it's still bigger than a carronade, can engage, obviously the longer barrel one you can aim a little bit more easily because it's got a somewhat flatter trajectory. Now, normally, you would think that maybe with the age of sail and cannon fire ranges, that's probably not a major issue because, well, if you're fighting up close and personal at under 500 yards, both kinds of guns can hit equally as well. And that would be true to a certain extent. However, the bigger trade-off would come basically with the larger the battle you fought in, because as, especially in that time period, battles get larger and larger and larger and you're fighting, therefore, less of a melee action and more of a standard ship of the line of battle action. In those line of battle engagements, distances could often be towards the upper end of where you could actually aim. So in the closed waters of the Baltic, and particularly a lot of the smaller engagements that the Swedish Navy was taking part in, it wouldn't have made too much odds, so therefore the trade-off was worth it. But if you were out in the deep ocean, you know, in a 30 versus 30 capital ship fight, if everybody was sailing in wonderful lines ahead, then this kind of rearmament could cause you to suffer because you might not be able to reach or accurately reach out at the longer ranges of those big line of battle engagements, at least in the early part of said engagement. Now, as far as why they wouldn't have been quite as good deep ocean performers as more standard ships of the line. Well, as I said, dimensionally, they are very similar to, say, HMS Agamemnon, one of Nelson's favourite ships. But there are a few minor differences in the rigging, not hugely. But one of the bigger tells that this is a ship that's very much designed for close-in work in the Baltic rather than long, deep oceanic voyages, is kind of twofold. And individually, it might not seem like too much, but over time, if you're on a long-distance oceanic expedition, it will make a huge difference. Now, firstly, the bow is significantly less built up than you will find on a lot of period, so late 1700s, third rates. So it's in heavy oceanic seas, you're going to take a lot more of a battering around the bow and a lot more water green, which obviously is going to not be particularly comfortable. The other thing is when you look at the stern, although it's kind of got a quarter deck going, when you actually look at cutaways and plans, it's more of an enhanced gunnels area. There isn't actually a tier of full accommodation back there. So as you can kind of see from the little window there aft, the main accommodation is on the upper gun deck level, which is itself a little bit open. Whereas if you look at something like Agamemnon and later successors to the Ardent class 64s, you'll see that on those ships, they have a fully built up quarter deck. They actually have two levels at least of accommodation in the stern and somewhat more cover on the decks going forwards, which A is obviously more weatherproofing and B more accommodation. And it's not just about accommodation per se, as in, oh, it's a nice to have additional space for people to live. It's also about overall storage for supplies, because crew numbers are going to be about the same. But if you don't have that additional accommodation up top and the ability to accommodate on the upper gun deck, because as you can see, you know, good chunk of it's open, then that means men have to be stored further down. And if they're stored further down, that means there's less space for supplies, which means you can't go as far, you can't sail as far as compared to a full oceanic ship of the line. And that's actually one of the major differences that you see as well with the design of HMS St. Lawrence, first rate ship of the line built on the Great Lakes, also without much of anything in the way of a quarter deck, precisely because it doesn't have to sail that far, so they don't have to worry about it that much, whereas something like Victory definitely does. Brian Smith asks, were there any differences between the 5-inch 38 caliber guns that were on the various classes of ships in the US Navy? Not as far as I'm aware. From what I can tell, if you took the first class of ship to receive a 5-inch 38 and you took the last class of ship to receive a 5-inch 38 and you lifted the guns themselves, i.e. the gun barrels, and swapped them around, fundamentally not really a huge amount is going to change. Where you do get quite a lot of changes with 5-inch 38 performance is, of course, you know, external systems like fire control and so forth, but also the ammunition, because there's loads of different types of ammunition that are manufactured for the 5-inch 38, combined with the mountings. And the mountings is where there's huge variation, because, of course, you've got different mountings with different amounts of elevation. Some mountings are powered, some are hand-operated, some you can do both. You've got single mountings, you've got twin mountings, you've got open mountings, you've got half shield mountings, you've got full shield mountings, you've got fully enclosed mountings. And even for the fully enclosed mountings, the amount of protection you get with that fully enclosed mounting differs, which is why sometimes, you know, an open single mount, sure, you can hand crank that quite easily. If you're talking about, say, some of the mountings installed on the battleships, which are twin mountings with, well, for a 5-inch 38 mount, a reasonable degree of protection installed, I mean, technically, you could hand crank the thing. It will take you forever and a day to move very far. So, practically speaking, you're relying on the powering of the system. And all of those in various combinations lead to huge varieties in the overall performance and utility of various 5-inch 38 mounts. But it's, at its core, it's still using the same gun. Conelead asks, how many times, if ever, has a warship's magazine been literally empty, i.e. every ounce of powder or shells or shot fired as a direct result of combat? It depends how you define combat, really. If you include shore bombardment in combat, because there is a small chance the enemy might shoot back, then there's quite a number of ships that have been engaged in shore bombardment duties, especially in the Second World War, who would empty their magazines of pretty much anything that was worth using on a shore target and would have to go back to restock. Hence the picture of HMS Warspite, because she, amongst various others, would empty their magazines multiple times in the D-Day landings. Similar things would happen in the Marianas operations and so on and so forth. However, if you want to be a little bit harsh on that and say, OK, what about ships that are actively engaged with the enemy and the enemy is actively shooting back at them, as opposed to, OK, yeah, shore troops, not hugely equipped with long-range naval artillery, so the average man in the trench can't really do much about being under battleship attack. So then you do have a few more examples. For example, during the invasion of Crete, a number of Royal Navy ships didn't necessarily run out of ammunition in, like, they still had, say, for example, 6-inch ammunition in their magazines, but they did run out of anti-aircraft ammunition and were subsequently sunk because they were unable to defend themselves in those calibers. They weren't completely bare, but you couldn't use the 6-inch shells on aircraft. So for the relevant portion of what they were shooting at, they were out of ammo. But then if you want to dial it down still further to ship-to-ship combat, there are a few qualified examples where a gun or a turret might run out of ammunition, but the other guns and turrets could continue firing. And of course, in the aftermath, assuming the ship survived, you could then move ammunition from other magazines. But in terms of, no, we are literally out of everything that we could potentially shoot at your opponent, USS Salt Lake City at the Battle of Komondorski Islands could be an example. She didn't run out of ammunition, period. She did still have some HE shells, but she did completely run out of AP shells during the Battle of Komondorski Islands, and she also ran out of shells in her aft magazines, and they actually had to actively ferry ammunition to them during the combat. And there's the often memed 18th century engagement between, I believe it was a Danish and a Swedish ship, both of which were flying false flags and or disguised flags, and one of them was being captained by an Englishman. So it was all very confusing. They had to sort out, you know, who is actually in command, and let's hoist our proper flags before we can have a fight. But that fight ended when one side ran out of ammunition and then very politely asked, can we borrow some of yours to keep fighting? At which point, obviously, the other side went, maybe not. And then they just toasted each other, had a drink, and sailed off again. And finally, W. Osterberg asks, assuming Britain doesn't enter World War I, the Germans beat France and end up consolidating Europe into something similar to the United States, how would the Royal Navy react to suddenly having the continent under one person or one country's control? I mean, there'd be several stages to that. First would be complete confusion as to how they'd managed it, because if Britain stays out of World War I and the Germans beat France, the Germans are still allied with Austria-Hungary, and if France, it looks like it's going to be rolled over pretty quickly, Italy's probably going to come out of its neutrality and say, hey, no, actually, yeah, we remember the Triple Alliance, we are actually on your side, which would mean that Germany can't really take over its two allies without being a massive treaty breaker and starting a whole new war. And you've also got the problem of, okay, Germany has managed to roll over the French army, taken a reasonable number of losses doing so. It's still got to deal with Russia. Admittedly, obviously, we know from history that that is possible in World War I, at least in terms of getting the Russians to back off out of Europe. But you've still got the mess that would be the remains of Eastern Europe. You've got Spain and Portugal. And, of course, the big question of what exactly are you going to do with the Austro-Hungarian Empire and Italy, as well as various other small European countries, Denmark, Scandinavia, etc., etc. So, if we assume, to make things sort of easy for Germany, that we're going, that they notionally form some kind of loose federation with Austria-Hungary and Italy, and then they just set out to try and take over the rest of Europe, the first reaction of the Royal Navy past the confusion would just be to go, okay, cool. Short term, have fun with that, because that's going to massively bankrupt Germany to the point there is no way they're going to be able to keep the high seas fleet going, because they're essentially going to be fighting probably a multi-decade war on mostly on land to take over Europe, at which point the Royal Navy probably just goes back to its standard MO of, well, we're going to keep blockading you and we are going to take all the trade, make all the money, and you're not going to make the money. And the money that we have is probably going to be put into funding people to fight you, which, yeah, that's going to bog Germany down something horrible. And realistically, if you have the German army spread out over the entirety of Europe trying to hold it all down, they're going to face so many rebellions that essentially everybody in Britain can sit back with tea and biscuits and watch most of Europe just continually tear itself apart. But if we want to construct some kind of highly implausible scenario, perhaps where Germany has invited the rest of Europe to unite under the "We Really Hate the British" banner, which isn't necessarily a completely unreasonable banner to try and rally all of Europe around, then that is the Royal Navy's worst nightmare. That's Britain's worst nightmare. You know, a single hegemonic European power is the one thing that the British Empire really, 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 really can't deal with, because it's going to have so much money, so much industry, and such a large army. And you might think, well, yes, you've still got to get across the channel to get to the Royal Navy. But the thing is, if everybody is merrily and happily getting along, you don't need the entirety of the combined armies of Europe. You can make do with the combined armies of any two largish European countries, numbers-wise at least, and that's still far more than Britain can ever really deal with, especially on its own soil. And then you can put all your money into building a massive navy with the entire industry of Europe behind you, which will outnumber the Royal Navy. And so at that point, the only real way to react to that would be either to go full on seizing absolutely everybody's colonies while this Federated States of Europe is being built, and hope that the total income from owning basically everything that's ever flown a colonial flag ever across the entirety of the world that will come along reasonably quietly will somehow help the British Empire's industry and commerce to somewhat approximate to that of all of Europe, and then start cranking out as many heavily armed ships as humanly possible whilst Europe tries to standardize down onto what kinds of ships it's going to build, and also make very good friends with the United States. And possibly at that point you might be able to build a massive Doom fleet approximately the size, or maybe fractionally larger than the European Doom fleet, but yeah, I wouldn't be holding my breath on that one. And at that point, because then we'll be talking about the 1920s, it's basically down to, okay, who decides to go full Copenhagen on the other side's ports first? And that brings us to an end to this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.